Good evening. We're learning Parshat Yitro, and our Parsha Yitro joins the Jewish people. He comes out from Midianite territory, which is somewhere eastward of Israel, eastward of Egypt. I don't know how far east it was. And Moshe goes out to greet him. When people see Moshe going, Aaron goes, and then the kids go, and then everyone tags along and ends up having this whole entourage come out to greet him. And Yisro is very happy when he hears all the good news of all the wonderful things Hashem has done for the Jewish people. And he offers sacrifices as thanks to Hashem. And the next morning he sees how Moshe is judging the people in their long lines. And he comes to Moshe and he says, this is a bad idea. Why are people waiting in line so long? This is a miscarriage of justice. People have to wait so long to get judged. Moshe says, they're coming to me to ask guidance from Hashem, and I'm teaching them. And he says, it's not good. You're going to wear down, and the nation's going to wear down. This isn't right. You need to ask Hashem if maybe you should set up a legal system here and have judges that'll help you. Get people who are God-fearing people, get people who are brave people, get people who are men of truth, get people who hate money, and appoint them in charge of the people. And they'll judge the people. And when things get difficult, they'll come to you. So Hashem says it's a good idea, and Moshe does that. We travel. This is an overview. We travel, and we come to Mount Sinai, and the people are told that I want to make you my chosen nation. Stick to my mitzvos. You're supposed to be a nation of Kohanim, whatever that means, a nation of leaders, nobles, a holy nation. And the nation is gathered. They're told to prepare for 3 days, and then no one should ascend the mountain. And then Hashem appears with early in the morning. There's thunder and lightning and heavy mountain heavy clouds on the mountain, and they hear the shofar blowing very strongly. It gets very scary, and Hashem appears. There's a lot of smoke coming out of Mount Sinai. And Hashem comes on the mountain and tells Moshe, go warn the people not to come up the mountain. So Hashem gives us the Ten Commandments. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of Mitzrayim. You may not have any other force you believe in other than me. Don't make yourself any figure, because I don't have a figure. Don't bow to any figure. I am zealous. I'm not going to let you get away with it, and I'll pay you back for generations to come. I pay back kindness for thousands of generations. Don't take my name in vain. Don't promise someone by God's honor this is true. I'm not going to forgive you for that. Remember the day of Shabbos. Make it holy. You work for 6 days. Do whatever you have to do. And on the seventh day is a day to rest in honor of Hashem, your God. Don't do any work. You, your children, your servants, your animals, and even the non-Jew who accepts the Noahide laws, who has joined you as a citizen, he also has to rest. I created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day, and that's why I bless this day and make it different. Serve your father and mother. It'll give you longevity. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal, kidnap. Meaning, don't steal people. Don't kidnap. No slave trade. Kidnapping people and selling them as slaves or making them work. Don't give false testimony. Don't desire your friend's house, his wife, his servants, his cattle, or anything he owns. So we have Ten Commandments. And the nation sees all of this, and they tremble in fear, and they run back 12 miles. They can't handle this. And they tell Moshe, we can't do more than this. From now on, you tell us the mitzvos. And Moshe says, Hashem did this to uplift you. Once you've seen this prophecy, this will give you strength, and forever you'll have a new respect of Hashem. And Hashem tells Moshe, tell the Jewish people, you've seen me give you my mitzvos, and be careful not to worship gods of gold and silver. I'm not a god of gold and silver. Don't make yourself any figurines. You want to serve me? Take the simple dirt, make yourself an altar, and over there you could serve me. Don't make fancy things that's not me. But wherever I allow you to mention my name, I will come and bless you, and you'll have an altar, you'll have a temple, and it will be a source of blessing for you. Don't try to bring blessing by making figurines of gold and silver and thinking you're honoring me. And when you make that altar, make sure you go up with a ramp. You might think you're serving God, it doesn't matter how you do it, and Hashem says, no. It's important to me that even as you serve me, you maintain modesty. Don't reveal your private parts. Even in the service of Hashem, sometimes people think it's fine, I'm serving Hashem, anything goes. No, not anything goes. You want to serve me, I want it to be humble, I want it to be made of dirt. And if you're going to make it of stones, that's fine, but you can't use a sword to cut, you can't use metal to cut the stones, because that would desecrate it. I want it to be something that does not involve death, only life. And I want you to approach it in a way that's modest. Don't climb steps, walk in a way that's modest. They used to wear like little skirts or something, and they didn't know, or robes, and the robes reached their knees. And when you'd lift your foot with a robe that reaches your knees, so then one's private parts get revealed. So that's why Hashem says, I don't want you climbing steps. Walk up a ramp, so you remain modest as you ascend to bring your sacrifices. And that's our parsha in a nutshell. Now, let's review. Okay. He's a convert. He's different than everyone else. They're all Jews, and he's the outsider coming in. But why is he different? They weren't Jews yet. What does that mean, they're Jews and he's not? What's going on here? The Jewish people have not become Jewish yet. We learn the laws of conversion from what will happen at the end of the parasha. The laws of conversion are actually derived from the process of the Jewish people receiving the Ten Commandments. There's a covenant. They immerse in the mikvah in preparation of accepting the Torah. They have a stand where Hashem appears and they accept the Torah. To replicate that, we have the Beis Din, who are supposed to represent Hashem, and the convert accepts the Torah on him. And then the blood of the covenant, so we have a sacrifice, which we cannot fulfill. And we have the circumcision, which the Jewish people circumcised as a part of approaching the Torah before leaving Egypt. So we have these components. That's conversion. So they were in the middle of a conversion process. They had said, we accept what Hashem says. They hadn't heard what Hashem says. They had circumcised, but they hadn't gone to mikveh yet. And Yisrael shows up. So the truth is that we have two approaches among our sages as to when Yisrael shows up on the scene. One opinion says that although it is written in the beginning of the parasha, it actually happens way after our parasha. Long after we receive the Torah, Yisro shows up. Which is a very sad story, because that would mean that not only Yisro, but also Moshe's own children, missed the wonderful event of Matan Torah. Moshe had to stand receiving the Torah, and his kids are not with him. That's terrible. That's terrible. So that's one interpretation as to what's going on here. The other interpretation says, no, it happened. Yisro showed up. But in the book of Devarim, we discover that Yisro left. So we have a second opinion that says Yisro showed up and gave us his 2 cents. He gave us his wonderful advice. And then Moshe says, stick around. Great things are going to happen. And Yisro says, no, I got to go. And Yisro leaves before the Matan Torah. So even if Yisro showed up in the beginning of the parasha, and the parasha leads us straight into Matan Torah, the parasha doesn't mention that Yisro left. He missed the greatest scene in world history. So why did Yisro miss it? So the Medrash says, because he didn't invest the labor that Am Yisrael invested. The Jewish people had just been through terrible suffering. Yisro hadn't paid the price. And this is an important theme in Chazal. We view suffering as something with a point. We don't always understand the point. But we don't view suffering as being pointless. We say Hashem cares, and everything is calculated, and Hashem is aware. And whatever the reason is, at the end of the day, there is some good that will come out of it. There has to be good that comes out of it. It's not for nothing. To the point where one opinion in Talmud says, you reach your hand into your pocket, you took out the wrong coin, so there's a reason. It's a little hard to live your life that way, because then every time you open a sitter, if you didn't open to the right place, what did I do wrong? Why didn't I get the right place? But Chazal wanted us to be open to the idea that Hashem created a world where if things aren't going perfect, there's a reason. It's not. Nothing here is by coincidence. So Yisro is an extraordinary person. But Yisro has not paid the price that everyone else has. And so he doesn't get to be there for Matan Torah. He's not there. He misses it. But at least Moshe's kids are there. Yes?
You said originally he's a convert. So what kind of status does that give him if he, what status does that give him if he converts, leaves, and then there's Matan Torah?
Right, he didn't yet convert. If he came before the receiving of the Torah, then he had to convert when he came back.
Uh-huh.
And he will rejoin us, or his family will rejoin us later.
Okay.
Yitro's family stays with us for generations. They become leaders of the Jewish people.
Okay.
They become members of the high court. Yitro's family works their way up there. They're phenomenal people. And when the rest of the people become hedonistic and they drink and they destroy their lives, so the Navi in Yirmiyahu in Jeremiah tells the Jewish people, go learn from Yisro's descendants. Look at what fine people they are. They don't drink. The children of Yonadav ben Rechav. So our sages say Yisro had 8 names. 7 names in Torah, and an 8th name that shows up in Navi and Prophets, Rechav. So his descendants end up being a part of the Jewish people.
So Yonadav
ben Rechav, yeah.
Why they bring in Yonadav and not just simply stating Rechav?
Seems that Yonadav, his son, was the one who made a family tradition of not purchasing houses, always living as nomadic tribes in tents, and not drinking alcohol.
Okay.
That was his tradition. I guess it wasn't Yisro, it was his son. Yes? So when Moshe was on his way back to Egypt, one of 3 things happened. Either Rashi's pshat, the Medrash, he showed up to Egypt and he meets his brother Aaron, and his brother says, who are these people? And Aaron says, my wife and kids. And Aaron says, Moshe says, my wife and kids. And Aaron says, everyone's suffering here. What'd you bring them to suffer? Why'd you bring them here? It's a dangerous place to live. Send them back. You don't bring them into Egypt. We regret anyone that walked in. Now you're going to bring more Jews to suffer here? Send them back. We'll pick them up later. Why should they suffer here? So Moshe listens to his brother and he sends his wife and kids back to live by her father. And he tells them, wait till the dust settles, when things will be okay, you'll join us, which is what they do in our parasha. The second opinion is that after they circumcised the boy, so they couldn't continue traveling with him. Moshe had to go into Mitzrayim. Tzipora had to wait till the boy was well enough, and then it was quicker to go back home. So she went back to her dad until she caught up to Moshe in this week's parasha. And the third opinion is, Ramban says, it could be that back in Egypt, Tzipora missed her dad. At some point she said, it's very hard for me to be here all alone, away from my family. And so Moshe said, okay, go be with your family a little bit. And during that time, whoops, we left Egypt. So they came out to the desert and they met us there. That's a shot the Ramban brings. What? Right. So we always have a choice. Great things happen in the world, and we choose whether we'll notice them or we won't, and whether they will inspire us or they won't. And this is a recurring theme in our lives. It's a choice we make. How will we view what happens in life? I walked off the bus 3 weeks ago, and the people to my right were saying, there's a murderer behind you, there's a terrorist attack behind you. So I turn to my left, and I see a car that had rammed into the posts that are there protecting the bus stop, and he had rammed into it literally 3 seconds before I walked off the bus. So I didn't even know about it. By the time I got off the bus, everyone was standing there watching, because there were soldiers he was trying to run over, and he didn't make it past the barrier. I mean, he thought his car, he had this pickup truck, he thought it would knock down the barrier, and the barrier knocked out the car. Meaning you saw a car split in two. Zoom, straight in, split in two. The soldiers turned around, he pulled the knife. After this big accident, he wanted to come and kill people, and they shot him dead. And all this happened in the 3 seconds before I got off the bus. Meaning when I got off the bus, the soldiers were still standing with their guns pointing at the car, and I could see the bullet holes. And I'm looking to my left, literally 4 feet away from me, right? So I look to my left, I look to my right. People are on their cell phones, people are taking pictures, and I say, that's nice. And I continue my merry way, right? And then I think to myself, I was almost killed, right? So I continue home, and my natural reaction was to ignore it. My natural reaction was to just walk home and forget anything happened. But I said to myself, that's not right. Had I walked off the bus 3 seconds earlier, I would have been there. I mean, the man was intent on mowing down Jews. He didn't care if it was me or someone else. So we can ignore amazing things that happen in our life. We could say, I mean, the guy hit a barrier. He didn't hit anyone, right? So what does it have to do with me? I wasn't there. Right. We can look at things and say it doesn't matter. We can look at many things that happen in our life and say, it doesn't matter. What does it have to do with me? Things can happen all around us, and we can say, what's it got to do with me? We make a choice in life. Are we going to pay attention to what happens around us? People see a burning bush and no one stops to look at why the bush won't burn down. Other than Moshe, says, hi, there's a fire, there's a cactus in the desert. Either the cactus is filled with water, the fire should go out, or the fire should overcome the cactus. The cactus should go out, but the cactus and the fire, neither one's winning. What's going on there? We have to make that choice. And if the story of Yisro chronologically did not occur now, then the reason the Torah writes it here is to show us the comparison between Amalek and Yisro. They're neighbors. Yisro lives near Amalek. And Amalek's on the eastern front of Israel, and Yisro is east of Israel. So that would put Yisro southeast, which makes sense that it's near Egypt, and that when when Moshe leaves Egypt on the run, he ends up in Midian in Yisro territory. Right? Egypt's on the southern border of Israel, down by Eilat. So you have Egypt down south. And then Amalek is southeast, and Midian is somewhere near Amalek. And so everyone heard of what had just happened. Amalek says, let me attack. If these people have a special relationship with God, let me fight them. And Yisro says, let me join them. Two approaches. What does the rest of the world do? It ignores it. That's classical.
Wait, Yisro wanted to join Amalek?
Am Yisrael. He wanted to join Am Yisrael. So, Yisro is impressed because when Moshe asked him for his agreement to go and lead the Jews out of Mitzrayim, Yisro thought his daughter might very well become a widow. He wasn't clear that the odds of Moshe living when he walks up in front of Paro and says, I need to take my people out of Egypt, Yisro wasn't clear that Moshe would walk out of it alive. And so when Yisro hears that Paro didn't kill Moshe, and Moshe succeeded in taking the people out of Mitzrayim, and that's why the Pasuk stresses two components. He heard what Hashem did for Moshe, because number one was he hadn't thought his son-in-law would make it out alive. Think about it. You walk in front of Saddam Hussein and you say, I'm taking out your servants. God sent me to take him out. You know, go, good luck. So Yisro agreed, but he wasn't sure Moshe would live to tell the tale. So Yisrael also knew Moshe's history. There was a death sentence hanging over his head when he re-entered Mitzrayim. So Yisro knew Moshe was re-entering a country where there was a warrant out for his arrest and a court ruling that he deserved the death penalty. And Moshe's walking right into that. And he's not hiding from anyone. He's walking back in front of that same king and saying, "Hi, I came to take my people out." Right? So Yisro was not so clear that Moshe would make it out alive, let alone succeed. So when Yisro hears how it all played itself out, Yisro is very excited. Yes? Yes. Says he was a Yetz. So we look at Yisro and we say Yisro is commendable, because when he saw the truth, he said, "I'm switching my life and I'm going after the truth." And that's why Yisro is the prototypical get. We have Yisro and we have Rut. We have two giants in Jewish history that we look at. And we say, when the rest of the world sees something that's right, they don't move, they don't budge. And when a person says, "If it's right, that's where I'm going," so then we look up to that person. They say that's extraordinary. And we will learn a lot about Geirim from Yitro. Number one, Yitro is ready to leave everything behind and come. Number two, after Yitro learns what he's learned, he says, "I got to go teach my family." Maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong. But it's a natural response. If he missed Matan Torah, then he paid a hefty price. If he got his whole family to convert, and then his whole family came to Israel and became part of the great people of Israel, then it sounds like it was a good move. Number three, Yitro has insights. And Yitro will share those insights out of respect for Hashem. He doesn't do it to go and tell everyone what's wrong. He does it to figure out what's the right way to do it. Number four, Moshe will start telling him everything that happened. You know how Hashem paid back the Egyptians? There were those Egyptians who were very evil. We could see them being tossed in the water. They didn't die for a long time. They were being tortured in that water, tossed up, tossed down, together with their chariots. And Moshe's telling him all this. And Moshe's telling him the 10 plagues. You can't imagine what Egypt has been going through the past year. And Yitro hears all of this. And the pasuk says, "Vayichad Yitro." Now the word "Vayichad" is Aramaic for happiness. Chadi in Aramaic is happiness. But in Hebrew, the word vayichad means he became sharp. From the word chad, sharp. And Chazal tell us that both feelings were a part of Yitro. On the one hand, Yitro was very happy for the Jewish people. He was happy for the good things that were happening to them, and that Hashem was taking care of them. On the other hand, that's his country. That's his home country. And when Yitro hears about their suffering, it hurts him. They were evil, but they're still his home country. And so that's why Chazal tell us, be very careful when you talk to someone who converted. There's going to be a natural loyalty to the country they came from. You have to respect it. Don't hurt their feelings. You shouldn't say, "You're one of ours, so you don't care about the country you came from." You're one of ours, and it's legitimate that you care. And I can tell you, I am not a ger. I didn't have that merit in this lifetime. But when the World Trade Center was hit, I felt very bad. And when I heard people saying, "The Americans are arrogant, so Hashem knocked down their arrogance," I said, why do you say that? The Americans are people who were able to unite to build something pretty amazing like the Twin Towers. And it's pretty sad that what the unity of thousands of people was able to construct, a few evil people were able to destroy, aside from the human lives that were lost. I would see the Twin Towers every day on my way into yeshiva. Rabbi Feinstein's yeshiva was a few blocks away from the Twin Towers, and I would see them in the clouds. I would see the clouds, literally. You could see sometimes the clouds would cover parts of the Twin Towers. And I would always stop before walking into yeshiva. I don't know about always, often. I would look and think to myself, that's what humanity can do when there's unity. No one person can build that. No one person. He works his whole life. No one person can build that. That's only a lot of people working together. Look at what unity could do. And I'd look at that, get inspiration, and walk in to learn. It always inspired me. So I felt bad when the towers were knocked down. It's not my towers. It's not my country. It doesn't technically have to affect me. Not true. There's a certain feeling of... it's more so when a person grew up feeling like this is mine. When a person grows up and he's Jewish in a foreign country, so on some level he knows, this isn't mine. This is theirs. When a person grows up in a country and he doesn't feel that Israel's mine, the Kotel's mine, the World Trade Center's nice. Statue of Liberty's nice. But if you grow up in France and from your end, you know, that's your Leaning Tower of Pisa, so that's part of your French pride, and then you become Jewish, and suddenly, okay, the Kotel's mine, but the Tower of Pisa was also mine. So, wait, that's Italy, no? Leaning Tower of Pisa. Okay.
Eiffel Tower.
You guys are very respectful, right? Very nice. No one said a word. Okay. So, at any rate, you guys got the message. We will move on. Yes?
Is it bad if a person doesn't have that sensitivity?
For other people?
No,
for his own home country? I don't think it's bad. It's natural if it is. He has it. It's not. Okay, so we move on. We see over and over again in Tanakh, great people treated their father-in-law with a lot of respect. Moshe Rabbeinu could have sent one of his helpers. My father-in-law is coming. Go pick him up at the airport. Oh, Moshe Rabbeinu goes out to greet him. Moshe Rabbeinu could have gone out without an entourage. He brings an entourage. Moshe Rabbeinu could have done it and not made a festive meal in honor of his father-in-law. No, his father-in-law came. It's a festive day. And we have to learn from this how to treat our parents and our in-laws. Your in-laws come, your parents come, stop what you're doing. You don't sit there working on the computer. Hi, Dad. Continue what you're doing. Stop what you're doing. You go out to greet them. You go out, and if you know they're coming up the block, you stand out there waiting for the car to show up. If they're landing at the airport, you go and greet them at the airport. We learned from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe was a busy person. He had better things to do with his life. No, you don't have better things to do with your life. You stop your life and you go to the airport. Your parents tell you, I can manage just fine. That's not the point. Go and be there. Same thing, parents, grandparents, in-laws. Moshe Rabbeinu is going for his father-in-law. You remember the Medrash, that when Moshe first showed up to Midian, Yisro threw him into a dungeon for a year to starve to death. That's the father-in-law he went out to greet.
Whoa, hello. Yeah.
Right? We discussed that Medrash a few weeks ago. So, I don't think your father-in-law is going to be that bad. Yes?
Talking about the separate places that you should call your father-in-law, like the Abba. Rashi also says that you should call your grandfather, Abba. Does that mean
it
has the weight
to
like all the degrees?
No. And I don't mean that's what Rashi says about grandfather. Check and tell me. Yes?
Where's the Saba? The word Saba.
Let's revisit that if you want on a Thursday night. Okay. So Yisro watches Moshe. There's a long line. Here we see the Jewish weakness of litigation. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to take you to Moshe Rabbeinu. Why should I give in on my rights, right? So many Jewish lawyers. We're a tiny country. We have the most lawyers per capita, I think. It's not a positive thing. It's a weakness. We shouldn't always litigate. Don't always have to go to court. Let's find a good solution. So people are coming to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Yisro tells him, this isn't justice. If a person was robbed, and he has to wait 2 weeks to get seen by you, he has 2 weeks where he doesn't have his objects. By detaining a justice, that's a miscarriage of justice too. This isn't fair what you're doing. And Moshe hears him. Moshe gets the message and he sets up a legal system. What system were they working with? That's a good question. It seems that Moshe set up some kind of legal structure for them to live by till they got the Torah. Okay, we move forward. Yisrael warns Moshe, you will wear yourself out. One of the weaknesses of leaders is that they try to do things themselves. A good leader wants to do things himself, but a person has to realize that the more you can delegate, the more you can accomplish. And delegation means things will not work out as well as if you did it yourself. But that is offset by your ability to do much more. If you're going to do things, you're limited to what you can do. If you delegate, then you have two advantages. A, you are only limited to as much as you can delegate. And B, you will discover that sometimes the person you delegated to has skills that you don't even have. You thought they're going to do it different than you, and sometimes they're doing it different. It's going to be much better than what you would have done. Sometimes that's a wonderful thing. Yeah, it's going to be different than how I would do it, and that's fine. So we move forward. We're traveling, and we come to the Sinai Desert. And for the first and only time, it says, "Vayichan Sham Yisrael neged ahar." Am Yisrael camped in unison. This was the only time that we camped as a united people. Every other time we camped, there were always fights. This is my territory, this is my tent, this is yours, this is that. Always fighting. And that's a negative thing, it's a weakness. Peace is something we have to create. Am Yisrael here, we're at peace. Moshe goes up, and Hashem tells him one of the very important rules of Torah. Hashem tells him, go talk gently to the women. And then talk toughly to the men. So, the first thing you're supposed to do is talk to the women. Years ago, about 22 years ago, there was a very wealthy person who lived in the neighborhood I was growing up in. He was on the front page of the New York Times when the stock market crashed in the 60s because he lost $500 million in the 60s. That's a lot of money. That's a lot more money than today. Okay, so he was on the front page of the New York Times. And that's what he lost. I'm saying, so he still had some pennies left, right? He had a museum in his backyard. We were friendly. I used to run a day camp, and I'd bring them every summer to see a tour of his museum of Judaica, and he'd love to give us this tour in his backyard. Okay. So I volunteered in an organization that gave food to the poor, and I told them, why don't we go to him and get him to donate? So they said, we've never been able to get a donation out of him. Maybe you can get a donation out of him. So I was a young kid. I said, fine, I'm going to go. I drove over to his house, and I told him, you got to see, this is an amazing organization. Come. So, fine. I convinced him. He came down. He saw the organization, and he didn't donate anything. So I went back to his house a few days later, and I said, isn't it an amazing organization? We were friends, I mean. He said, yeah, it's a great organization. I said, good, so what are you going to donate? So, his wife was in the kitchen peeling potatoes, and he said to me, you convinced me, you didn't convince her. So I sat there thinking, I don't talk to ladies. And he said to me, it doesn't work that way. Let me teach you in life. You convince her, you'll get good donations. You didn't convince her, we're not going anywhere. So I said, no, thank you, and I left. I wasn't interested in talking to his wife. I didn't think that was appropriate. But the Medrash says not like me. The Medrash says, when Hashem wanted to give the Torah, so the Hashem said, if you want the Jewish people to adhere to the Torah, convince their wives first. Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, talk to the women first. And Hashem tells him, talk gently. One of the things that amazed me was to see my Rebbeim talk when my wife would come. Every so often, we'd have a question that was relevant to the whole family, and I wanted my wife to be there when I asked the question and when we got the answer, to share her angles of the question. So it happened a few times that I came with my wife to different Rebbeim. And it blew me away. Rav Moshe Halberstam, I'd sometimes ask him a question, and he'd say, nonsense, and get out of here and be well. And then he'd smile and say, I said be well. I said be well, but get out. Boom! Kicked me out of his office. And it wasn't nonsense. My questions weren't nonsense. He was trying to teach me a perspective. Later on, I found the ideas I had written in halacha commentaries. It wasn't nonsense. But he wanted me to have that perspective, that this is not I had invented a certain leniency in a certain halacha, and I came to him and I said, why can't we apply this leniency? I looked at me and said, ridiculous, nonsense, out, goodbye. Years later, I discovered that Rabbi Feinstein said what I had said years earlier. But he didn't want me to have that perspective. He said, when you'll be 70 years old, you'll have a right to write what Rabbi Feinstein said. At your age, you have no right to say such a leniency. So, okay, he was teaching me something. He was tough as nails. He would sometimes tell me an answer, and I'd start arguing with him, and he'd say, don't say A, and don't say B, and don't say C. And he'd give me the arguments I was about to say. He'd say, I know you're about to tell me A, and that's wrong. And then you're going to tell me B, and that's wrong. And if you're even thinking of telling me C, that's also wrong. Goodbye. End the conversation. Now, he didn't prove it to me. So I'd sit there and I'd go, could you show me a source? Like, why is that wrong? So we ended off many times, like, I'll show you one day. And he hasn't yet shown me. He passed away and he didn't show me. But it was very tough. Very tough. It's frustrating. I would have to travel an hour to spend 5 minutes with him. An hour there, an hour back, and sometimes 2 minutes into the conversation, he'd kick me out of the room. That's very tough. And my wife showed up, and suddenly he's the sweetest old grandpa on earth. He's speaking gently, and did you understand? And he's going through everything he's saying, sweetly, gently, and if she asks questions, he never says nonsense. He explains calmly. Blew me away. That's this pasuk. Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, go talk sweetly to the women. You want to get your message across to them, you have to know how to talk sweetly. We as men very often think that it's legitimate to say, no, I said no. You talk to your wife the way you talk to your buddy, it's not going to work. And many men walk into marriage or into relationships thinking, I'm not going to put up with this nonsense. No. No. Right? Mark out what you think. But maybe we should, and maybe it's not fair, and maybe you should reconsider, and maybe I said no. But what do you mean you said no? That's the way you talk to your wife? That's why most men talk to their wives, because she says things that are annoying to you as a male. As a male, you say things one way, and when she says them as a female, so the Ribbon Shalom tells Moshe, go talk to them softly, go talk to them gently, and if you pay attention in Tanakh, the leaders of Israel spoke gently. When they didn't speak gently, the Tanakh rarely sides with them. Rav Nachman's wife was annoyed. They benched and they didn't offer her from the cup of wine. And the cup of wine is supposed to help her get pregnant. So they'll bench tomorrow. What's the big deal? So you missed one cup of wine. She goes up to the attic, she takes a sledgehammer and bashes 400 barrels of wine. Bam! 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 That's a damage, you know. She just damaged her husband. I don't know. 100,000 shekel, 200,000 shekel. She just gave me huge over one cup of wine. So what does he tell her? He says, "Sweetie, so you got your wine now, right?"
Would have been scared.
I'm saying, what would we say? By what right? Who's going to pay for that wine? Do you have any idea what you just did to our finances? All kinds of wonderful lines. You look throughout the Shas, you see this concept. Talk to them gently. It's not because they're right. They might be wrong. You want to accomplish something? Talk their language. Talk gently. Doesn't mean give in. You could talk gently and not give in, but talk gently. Moshe Rabbeinu is sent to the women first. And then he's told how you talk to men. To men, you say, get out. Right? You have to be tough. So, Am Yisrael is told, I want you to be my chosen people. I want you to be my treasure. I want you to be my nation of leaders. We're given a mission in this world. We're supposed to affect the world. And Moshe gathers in the elders, and the nation says, whatever Hashem says, we're prepared to do. So we learned the Gemara in Shabbos in our Ein Yaakov class that the early Christians would mock us. They'd say, you didn't even know what you were getting yourself into. And the answer is, that's right. When you trust, then you say, I don't know what I'm getting myself into, but I trust. Sadducees. Okay. You were in class, no? We discussed it there. We discussed in class whether it was a Sadducee or an early Christian. Moshe Rabbeinu is concerned. When Hashem told him to take out the Jewish people from Egypt, he said, if I'm going to be a sorcerer, another miracle worker, I don't want it. If they're going to believe in me, because I do fabulous things like turning a stick into a snake and a snake back into a stick, send someone else. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I don't want a people that will believe because of a miracle. I don't want to lead the people because they saw fantastic miracles, because in the end, when you see a miracle, you have to ask yourself, was it real? I hear there are miracles in South America too. There's this guy there who coughs and spits and then spits out gold. So I was a magician. I know how to do that too. There are all kinds of tricks you can do. So there are really all kinds of tricks you can do. And Moshe says, if they're going to believe in me because of that, I don't want it. And their bone shown promises him that won't be the reason. And that's why you will be believed for eternity. And now we're going to work our way through. What I'm going to describe now is a combination of Rambam and Ran. The first two commandments say, I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt. Do not have any gods other than me. We have a tradition that the first two commandments we heard directly from Hashem. After that we rushed to Moshe and said, we can't handle this. You tell us the rest. One Medrash says the people died. They came back. They died again. They couldn't handle hearing prophecy. So the Ran explains that human logic does not accept the concept that God will talk to us. You tell me God spoke to you? That's nice. That's nice. Go to a mental hospital. What do you want from me? So God spoke to you? Okay. You're telling me God is eternal and we are dust. You're telling me God always was and always will be. And I am a fleeting blip in world history. What am I? What can I do to him? What can I do for him? Ah, but I'm important. He's talking to me. Okay, maybe. Maybe. So talk to God and tell him I want $1 million. Ah, it didn't work. So explain to me. When do you talk to God and when not? Can you tell me what the lottery numbers for tomorrow are going to be? You don't know. Okay. But logically, I'm supposed to understand that an infinite God spoke to finite man in a finite moment, and man matters, and God cares what you do. Why? So human logic, says the Ran, detests this concept. Human logic says, no, that doesn't make sense. And that's why the first commandment had to be heard by man from God directly. Because after all of Moshe's miracles, if Moshe would continue telling us, God said, we would say, you know, you're doing things I can't explain, but my logic still says God didn't say. I don't understand why God would talk to you, Moshe. But if we ourselves experience a clarity that Hashem is talking to us, then even if I can't explain why, I can understand that. I don't understand why God does certain things, but I can understand that God spoke to man. If we didn't experience that first revelation of Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, your God, and I took you out of Egypt. So Hashem is telling us, one, I communicate with you. Two, I act. I care. I took you out. Meaning, even though I'm infinite and you're finite, I do something for you. I'm connecting to man. And that is something we don't understand. We can't explain it logically. I don't know why. Why did God create the world? Why does God care what I do? Why is it important to God? but he told me so. So even if I don't understand him, I can know that he has done that. He has said that. So we have three opinions with regard to the first commandment. Rambam says it's a commandment. You have to understand, reach a level of emunah. Hashem created the world. He's the all-powerful being. The opposing opinion says, no, that's not a commandment. You can't command me to do that. That is the prerequisite to all commandments. If God created the world and gave us the Torah and took us out of Egypt, then the whole Torah is relevant. If I don't have that, I don't have anything. It's either when I have that, I have everything. If I don't have that, I have nothing. You can't command me to have that. So Rambam says, study, learn, develop your understanding, get there. The other opinion, there is an opposing opinion, says it's not a commandment. It's a prerequisite. It's intro. Hi, I exist. I am God. And you have commandments. That is not a commandment in its own right. It's introductory. So we have two opinions as to whether that first commandment is a commandment. Then we have the Ran, who says it's a commandment, but not like Rambam. It's a commandment, and its importance is because it helps us connect to a concept that defies our logic. That's the importance of the first commandment. Now, after we've understood that first commandment, we come to step two, says the Ran. And step two says, why do you care? I ate kosher or I didn't eat kosher. Does it matter to you? Why would it matter to you? Says Hashem, Lo yelecha. Don't worship anyone else. Why not? What do you care? God, what, how does it affect you? Did I hurt you? What difference does it make? When Hashem goes to commandment number two and says, I'm telling you what not to do, what Hashem is telling us is, I care what you do. And that is, again, a concept that defies our logic. Why would he care? He's perfect. I can't evict him. I can't take anything away from him. I can't give him anything. So why does it matter? Why would he care if I do a mitzvah or I don't do a mitzvah? So then Hashem shows up and says, I do. And I'm telling you not to. So then I'll say, but why? I don't understand. And the answer is right. You don't understand, but I told you it's so. You do understand. You don't understand. It's irrelevant. I'm telling you, Hashem says in the second commandment, I care. And this is what I expect of you. And so the Ran says that's why those first two had to be from Hashem. Coming back to Moshe Rabbeinu and the Ribbono Shel Olam, Moshe Rabbeinu did not want to take the Jews out of Egypt. Explains Rambam, Moshe Rabbeinu said, I don't want them to believe based on miracles. And when they got to Sinai, what happened was they didn't need miracles. They each witnessed it. And that, now we will come back to the Rambam's opinion. Says the Rambam, why do we believe any prophet? No. Why do we believe any prophet, says the Rambam? We believe a prophet because after we saw the revelation at Sinai, so we understood Moshe was telling the truth. If not for the revelation at Sinai, we would accept Moshe as a probable truth. After the revelation of Sinai, we say we all saw it, so Moshe's telling the truth. If Moshe Rabbeinu has our backing because of the revelation at Sinai, it's like you, and me, we both saw something. So when you tell me something, you're talking to me about something I saw. So I know you're telling the truth. Now, comes a new prophet and says, I'll do a miracle. I'll make the sun stop. And now I want you to start worshiping Buddha. And I say, no. And he'll say, but I made the sun stop. And I'll say, yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm very impressed. But I'm still not worshiping Buddha. And he'll say, why? Why? Isn't that a fantastic miracle? I can make the sun stop? And I'll say, yeah, it's pretty amazing. And if I had a Jewish court, I'd kill you right now. But I don't. And I can't do that. I mean, you did a pretty fantastic trick. And then he'll say, but theologically explain it to me. If I could make such a miracle, then don't I show you that God's on my side? And then shouldn't you worship what I'm telling you? And then I say no. And he says, but why not? And I say, because I don't do Torah because of a miracle. I do Torah because we as a people were there with Moshe. And as a people, we were shown that Hashem runs the world. We were shown that Hashem is the omnipotent one. Ask me what the Jewish people saw at Sinai, I don't know the answer. I don't know what they saw that was so convincing. I don't know. I know they saw the miracles of the Mun for 40 years. They saw a revelation of Hashem that was crystal clear to them. I know they saw 10 commandments. I know they experienced prophecy and they knew it wasn't a hallucination. They knew it was clear. They knew it was true. But more than that, I don't know. I was never a prophet. I don't know to explain more than that. But I know it was clear. I know it was the masses. I know it was 2 million people who witnessed it. And so when I accept the Torah, I'm not doing it because Moshe made a miracle. You made a more impressive miracle. I'll believe you. No. Miracles are not what's going to get me to go somewhere. People make mistakes. They ask, how big is the rabbi? Tell me, how many miracles did he do for you? That's what makes him a big rabbi. That's not our gauge. He can walk on water and we'll say, that's very nice. Good for you. Okay. Whether he did or didn't is irrelevant to us. We say that there are people who can do phenomenal things. Yes, there are people who can do phenomenal things. That doesn't make them God. That doesn't make them a messenger of God. There are ways of tapping into forces in nature. So if a person can cure people, or if a person can do phenomenal things that other people can't do, we look at it and we say, good for you. That's very impressive. That's very nice. Okay. So, say that. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu is told, I'm going to show up. The nation has to hear me talk to you. Because that's what will make the nation believe what you're saying. The revelation at Sinai was important, not only because 2 million people got a massive revelation, but also because they got a revelation that validated that Moshe is a real prophet. And that revelation, not because it's awesome, but because we witnessed what Moshe witnessed. It was a once in a world occurrence that a nation got prophecy. And the Torah promises us in Parshas Vayeshanan, it never happened before, it'll never happen again. We had a student in class once whose parents had become missionaries. You were there? Okay. And I'm in the middle of telling them this over in either Parshas Yisro or Vayeshanan. And he raises his hand and he says, in the New Testament it says that Jesus had a revelation and there were millions of people present who saw the mass revelation. And I said to him, it doesn't say that in the New Testament. And he said, yes, it does. And I said, you have a smartphone. Bring me the quote. It doesn't say that in the New Testament. So all the guys were looking at me like, how do you know? So I said, it's very simple. The Torah says it never happened before. It'll never happen again. So if a person wants to say, I saw, me and 50 people saw, you can get away with writing that. You want to write that millions of people saw, you won't get away with writing that. And there's no verse that'll say that. So the guy says it does. I said, fine, you have the rest of the class till class ends to find me where it says it in the New Testament. And it didn't say that in the New Testament. He misremembered. It says over there, someone says they saw mass revelation and the people with them saw it. And that it doesn't say there were millions. It doesn't. Okay. I'm not ignoring you, Benny. I'm just not addressing you because I can't. We have to finish the thought. So, the point of the prophecy of Moshe and our being there with him is that this will give validity to Moshe and the Torah that cannot be matched. Meaning it has to have the whole nation see a prophetic vision. And from there, we have the concept that we will accept prophets. We have a system from there. But I purposely put the Rambam together with the Ran, even though there are pivotal points to disagree on, but there's a pivotal point that the Ran really elucidates in the Rambam. Once we see the Ran, that human logic defies the concept of prophecy. That's why I began with that humorous concept. The person walks in and says, God spoke to me. We tell him, I'll get an ambulance. I'll get you to the hospital. There'll be nice people in white coats and they'll take good care of you. Because human logic says, no, God didn't talk to you. I have no reason to think God spoke to you. Oh, if you think God spoke to you, so tell me what other little angels spoke to you lately. Because you have a problem. My logic says, God did not speak to you. So wait a second. So why did we ever accept a prophet for being sane? Because he did a miracle? Answer, no. I accept him because of what happened with Moshe at Sinai. Because we with Moshe saw that. And then Moshe got our acceptance as telling the truth. And then Moshe tells us, there will be future prophets. It's not only me. So now when a prophet walks in, I say, okay, based on my logic, this shouldn't be happening. But obviously God is not running the world based on my logic, because God told us that there will be prophets. Ah, so if you're a prophet, the only reason I accept you as being a sane individual is because of what I heard from Moshe. So wait a second, what did Moshe tell me? Moshe told me that you better not change the Torah. If you're going to try to change the Torah, I'm supposed to kill you. Ah, you make a miracle, you make the sun stop, you can do a whole bunch of amazing things, it doesn't matter. My original point was, I'm not going to believe a prophet, I'm going to say the man's crazy. I have no reason to believe him. Even if he could tell me tomorrow the sun will stop at 6 p.m. Okay, so he can do impressive things, that doesn't mean he's not crazy. Ah, so now I'm supposed, why do I believe him? Because of Moshe. Because of what happened with Moshe. So then he will only be accepted through that prism, in that system. And that's why I dare kill a prophet if he walks in and goes against the Torah. Why? Why is the Torah more powerful than him? He's saying prophecy, the Torah said prophecy. Why don't I accept Ahmed? There are many reasons, but the basic reason is this is the system. And this is the logic. What I tried to do now was build the logical case that the Ran develops, mixing Ran and Rambam, to understand that system. Benny, we will have to talk separately. I got 6 minutes left of the class. We got to cover the class. Okay, when a man emits his seed, he becomes defiled. That seed can live inside a woman for 3 days. And that's why the Torah says, separate from your wives 3 days before receiving the Torah. Because as a woman, after a man and a woman are intimate, so initially when she'll sit up and stand up, most of the seed will drip out. But for the next 3 days, you could still have residual dripping. And in ancient times, women could sense when this happened. Today, women don't sense it as much. But in ancient times, they sensed it. And any time some of the man's seed comes out of her, she becomes defiled all over again. And that's why, so long as that seed is relevant. Torah says, for 3 days that seed can live. And that's why for 3 days, separate from your wives 3 days before giving the Torah, so that the women will be able to be in a state of purity and come close and receive the Torah. Science today has borne this out, that the male seed can last within a woman for 3 days before it dies. The nation goes to mikvah. The nation purifies themselves and their vessels, and they prepare in purity. They separate from their wives for 3 days. And that morning, Hashem shows up, and Mount Sinai, which had been bare, now becomes covered with beautiful plants and vegetation and flowers and growth. And Hashem shows up on a humble mountain. There are many bigger mountains around, and Hashem shows up on a humble, low mountain. That's an extraordinary thing. You think there's Bonshom showing up, he's going to choose the biggest mountain around. That's not what we would expect at Sinai, right? No, Hashem shows up on a lower mountain. He teaches us a concept of humility. You're giving us the Torah, aren't you coming to impress us? I'm coming to teach you humility. So Moshe wants to be on top of the mountain during the Ten Commandments. And Hashem tells him, go down and warn the people. And Moshe says, I did. The people know they're not allowed to climb the mountain. And Hashem says, yeah, go warn them again. Because at the moment, it might get exciting. People will want to charge the mountain. So Moshe goes down the mountain. And when he's down the mountain, Hashem starts the Ten Commandments. So to speak, Moshe can't make it back up. Hashem wants Moshe at the bottom of the mountain. There shouldn't be any room for people to say it was Moshe on an amplifier up there. Hashem says, be there with the people when I give the Ten Commandments. They should see you. You should be among them. And the Medrash says Moshe didn't want that. He said, I'm capable. I want to be up closer to you at the time. Hashem says, no. The first commandment, Hashem identifies himself. I took you out of Egypt. Hashem does not identify himself as, I created the world. This is the famous line in the Kuzari, that Hashem says, you know me through the exodus from Egypt. After the exodus from Egypt, you can understand I also created the world. But your meeting ground with me was the exodus from Egypt. Hashem says, don't worship other forces. Hashem says, don't make idols. When you go touring in Mexico, they sell idols. In the Far East, they sell idols. You're not allowed to buy that. You're not allowed to have that in your home. Even if the previous tenant left it for you, you're not allowed to. We do not make shapes of the sun and the stars and the moon. Even when children draw pictures. So we don't tell them, yeah, draw a beautiful sun. If it's part of a picture, we don't make an issue of it. But when I wanted to teach the kids about the cycle of the moon, I gave them homework. Every night, they had a notebook, they had to draw what the moon looked like. So they would notice as it wanes and waxes, and suddenly a rabbi saw what I was doing. He said, you know, you're not allowed to do that. I said, why am I not allowed to do that? He said, no, that's this mitzvah. You don't draw figures in the sky. You don't sit there drawing a moon. You don't sit there drawing a sun. He's right. Hashem says, don't swear in my name in vain. That's why in the United States, when they tell you, put your hand on the Bible, do you solemnly swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth? Yeah, so the Supreme Court ruled, we're allowed to say, I affirm. We don't say, I swear. Torah says, remember the day of Shabbos. So I was standing with a friend of mine, and we were standing by a kiosk, and there was the last chocolate bar, and he bought it. Now he needs to diet. I said to him, Shraga, you shouldn't eat that chocolate bar. He says, it's a delicious chocolate bar. I said, Shraga, it's not good for you. He said, but you don't know, this is a good chocolate bar. I said, Shraga, you want to eat it? Save it for Shabbos. So he says to me, why should I save it for Shabbos? I said to him, you have a biblical mitzvah. Remember the day of Shabbos. Remember the day of Shabbos means when you have something special, which you won't be able to get. I said to him, this kiosk, that was the last of that chocolate bar, right? So it's the last one. You could stand there now and eat it, and you'll be a glutton. You could save it for 2 days till Shabbos, and you did a mitzvah. The biblical mitzvah of remembering Shabbos. My goal was he'd bring it home. He and I both knew that when he gets home, his wife would say, no, you don't. So he says to me, my wife won't let me eat it on Shabbos anyways. Then she'll see. So I'm going to remember today. Okay. And he ate the chocolate bar. But my argument was real. The argument is, if he would save it for Shabbos, then that's the biblical mitzvah. Remember the day of Shabbos. You have something special, save it for Shabbos. The Torah says, on Shabbos we're not allowed to do any tasks, ourselves or our children. People sometimes think, if the light's off, I'll ask the kid to turn it on. Torah says your kids also have to keep Shabbos. If a kid is very little and they don't realize what they're doing, a kid is 1 year old and they're moving their hands and they don't realize, there's room to say that they didn't actively turn on the light. But a kid's 3 years old and you tell him, what does this switch do? And then he turns on the light, and you say, oh no, it's Shabbos. Come on. Yeah, the Torah says your kids have to keep Shabbos. So there's a biblical mitzvah. You're not allowed to lend or rent out your animal to someone who will work it on Shabbos. If you rent out your animal, even to a non-Jew, you have to say on Shabbos it has to be back home. When we make Kiddush on Shabbos and when we make Havdalah, that is the biblical mitzvah of remembering Shabbos. Before I make Kiddush, I'll very often ask my family members, what are we doing now? Kiddush. What are we doing now? Which mitzvah are we doing now? Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. When we make Kiddush, we're doing the mitzvah d'oraita. We should have in mind of honoring, remembering the day of Shabbos. And we will pick up here, Be'ezrat Hashem, on Thursday night.